You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Order, order.
Good evening, this is Susan Hume at Westminster. Coming up tonight, the Home Secretary says she's disappointed that there is still nobody to lead the inquiry into child abuse.
And for that, I want to tell survivors that I am sorry.
Also, dismay at a benefits freeze for low-income working families.
Why is he balancing the books on the backs of the working people? Yeah.
And Britain in Europe, does the UK's new man at the Commission think we've got troubles ahead?
No, I don't. And that isn't how it has struck me so far.
But first tonight, the Home Secretary has said she is sorry for the delay in finding somebody to chair the wide-ranging inquiry into the sexual abuse of children. Two prospective chairs have now resigned. Fiona Wolfe stepped down last week over her social links to the ex-Home Secretary Lord Britton, whose handling of abuse claims in the 1980s has been questioned. The first choice to lead the inquiry, Lady Butler Sloss, withdrew 4 months ago, also over her establishment connections. Today, Theresa May confirmed that the panel would begin work without a chair, but she had a personal message for the victims of child abuse.
I know you have experienced terrible things. I know we cannot imagine what that must be like. And I know that perhaps because of the identity of your abusers or the way you were treated when you needed help, many of you have lost trust in the authorities. I know some of you have questioned the legitimacy of this process. I know you're disappointed that the panel has no chairman. I understand that. I am listening, and to you I say this. I am as determined as you are to get to the truth.
That, she said, was why she'd set up the inquiry, adding that it was a once-in-a-generation chance to expose what had gone wrong in the past and prevent it going wrong in the future. She said the panel would get to work right away, meeting 9 days from now and then weekly until Christmas, but...
It is obviously very disappointing that we do not yet have a panel chairman. And for that, I want to tell survivors that I am sorry. To put it bluntly, Mr. Speaker, it will not be straightforward to find a chairman who has both the expertise to do this hugely important work and has had no contact at all with an institution or an individual about whom people have concerns.
As for how to find a new leader, she'd be holding meetings with the survivors of child abuse and with interested MPs, including the Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper. Up next, Yvette Cooper said she welcomed Theresa May's announcements and her apology for what had gone wrong.
Ministers need to engage directly themselves with survivors over the impartiality of the chair, over the work and purpose of the inquiry before it starts. So I welcome her commitment now to meet with survivors, particularly to develop additional support and counselling, and also to establish a survivors' forum or liaison group to make sure that their voices are heard.
But it could hardly be an impossible task to find a new chair.
Will she ignore those siren voices who say it isn't possible to find someone who isn't a close contact of those whose decisions may be investigated by the inquiry? She will know that other sensitive inquiries have managed to do important work without going wrong and without being derailed.
Several MPs were unhappy at the revelation that Home Office officials had been involved in redrafting the letter sent by Fiona Wolfe to the Home Secretary describing her contact with Lord Britton. Yvette Cooper called it unwise. Another Labour MP, Simon Danchuk, who's campaigned vigorously over child abuse in his Rochdale constituency, was worried too.
The role of the Home Office in the redrafting of Fiona Wolfe's letter in many ways displays the kind of self-preservation instincts held by the Home Office that got us into this mess in the first place. Who instructed the civil servants to assist Fiona Wolfe in redrafting that letter?
The Home Secretary said she'd know nothing about that redrafting.
The process, as I understand it, was that Fiona Wolfe wanted to ensure that she was as transparent as possible in the information that she gave in the letter that she sent to me, and therefore went through a number of drafts in order to ensure that all information was available. As I've indicated, I was not aware of those iterations of drafts of the letter.
A Conservative, Steve Baker, was worried that the panel would now start work too quickly.
I welcome my right honourable friend's desire to see the committee's work start as soon as possible, but does she share my concern that the longer their work continues, the harder it will be for a chair to pick up that work and assert themselves? Could I just press her to explain a little further the extent to which she's considered asking a panel member to take the chair?
The Home Secretary said she understood that point, but she'd be looking at a variety of names. There's been speculation about when the Home Office will publish another report, one by Peter Wanless of the NSPCC, looking into the Home Office's own failure to act on child abuse allegations in the 1980s and 90s. The Home Office has the report, and Theresa May said it would be published next week. But a Lib Dem, Duncan Hames, hoped that the delay did not indicate that there was some cover-up and that
officials in her department are not engaged in redacting any material from that report that they do not consider suitable for placing in the public domain.
Mrs. May tried to reassure him.
I mean, it's not just a formality for me to receive a report of that sort. I have actually given it consideration. I have asked some questions to ensure that the report and the work actually has addressed the terms of reference that were given.
But Mrs. May said her prime reason for not publishing the Wanless report today was to allow that inquiry's findings to be looked at separately from her announcements. Now, the government's been accused of balancing the books on the backs of working people by its decision to freeze some in-work benefits. Low incomes among people in employment has become a big theme for the opposition, but the issue ended up being overshadowed by a row about why the Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary was missing from the Commons last Tuesday, Joanna Shin reports.
Employment figures are looking increasingly healthy, so the battleground as the election approaches is just what sort of jobs those are and how well they're able to support working families. Benefits such as child tax credit top up the incomes of working families on low pay. Labour's Chi Onwuah said many were struggling.
Half of all those in poverty are in working households. In the North East, working people are £1,800 per year worse off since this government came to power, and only a quarter of a million of them don't even get the living wage. So now he decides to freeze working tax credits. Why is he balancing the books on the backs of the working people? Yeah.
But the Work and Pensions Minister, Steve Webb, said those benefits had risen faster than wages.
Whilst average wages have risen by around 10%, working age benefits have risen by around 20%, a sign of our commitment to those who are most vulnerable, despite the black hole in the public finances which we inherited.
The Conservative, Andrew Bridgen, said that work was the best route out of poverty.
I welcome the news that in the last 12 months we've seen the largest annual fall in unemployment since records began. And does the Minister share my view that the best way out of poverty is through sustainable employment and a regular pay packet, something enjoyed by an extra 847 of my constituents since January 2013?
But Labour's Helen Jones said that depended on how large that pay packet was.
According to the government's own figures, 20% of working people in my constituency earn less than the living wage, and yet they will lose hundreds of pounds a year through this government's freeze in working tax credit. Yeah. How does that possibly reward people who want to work, and how can he justify that when the government gives tax cuts to the wealthy?
Yeah.
Steve Webb insisted working people were better off.
Under this government, a typical basic rate taxpayer is £800 a year better off in cash terms as a result of our changes to the personal income tax allowance, and over 3.2 million individuals will have been taken out of income tax altogether.
The Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary, Rachel Reeves, reminded the House it was living wage week, a figure above the minimum wage, which is calculated to reflect the cost of living. This week it has been raised by 20 pence to £7.85 per hour.
Under this government, the number of people paid a living wage has risen from 3.6 million to 4.9 million today, more than one in five people. Does the Secretary of State agree that this government's failure to tackle low pay means that more people in work are living in poverty, and it is a key reason why the government is spending on housing benefit £400 million more for people in work than when they came into office?
But the Work and Pensions Secretary, Ian Duncan-Smith, started his reply on a different topic.
Can I say to the Honourable, it's good to see her. I know that she didn't turn up and vote for her own motion last week, but that didn't even sign it. But anyway, now we have her here. I answer this question by simply saying this to her. The reality is, for this government, is that we have raised the minimum, seen the minimum wage rise faster under this government than under the last government, nearly 10% rise since the election.
He was referring to a motion on an Opposition Day debate on welfare reform. An angry Rachel Reeves asked him to withdraw the remark.
I would like the Secretary of State to withdraw what he said about me not being here last week. He doesn't know the reasons why I wasn't here, and I expect him to withdraw those comments.
But Mr. Duncan Smith didn't withdraw his comments when he got up next. Rachel Reeves, still clearly angry, took her complaint up with the Speaker a few minutes later.
The Secretary of State criticised me for not turning up to vote on an Opposition Day motion last week. The Secretary of State knows nothing for why I was not able to attend last week, and I would kindly ask him to withdraw his criticism and apologise for the aspersion that I couldn't be bothered to turn up to vote in the House of Commons.
Ian Duncan Smith was unrepentant.
I simply made the point that it was good to see her here because she hadn't turned up to vote at the last election. As I also understand that she retweeted that she was in Rochester at the time, but nonetheless, she didn't actually then put down she wasn't a signatory to the motion. And those are the points that I made.
I did not, said Rachel Reeves, to the suggestion she tweeted she was on the by-election campaign trail in Rochester. The Speaker attempted to calm things down.
We cannot have a protracted exchange on this one matter, but if the Honourable Lady has anything further that she wishes to add, I'm content that she should do so. Rachel Reeves.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was not in Rochester last week. I'll give the Secretary of State one last opportunity to withdraw the assertion and to apologise.
But Mr. Duncan Smith did not, and Rachel Reeves left the chamber. Later, her spokesman confirmed that she had been ill all of last week and that Monday was her first day back.
Joanna Shin reporting. Now, the government has promised that the rules for the recall of MPs will not give wealthy individuals the power to unseat them. MPs were discussing the bill which creates a mechanism for MPs to be got rid of between elections by means of a petition and possibly a subsequent by-election. Anyone spending more than £500 has to become an accredited campaigner, and there's an upper limit of £10,000. The Deputy Commons Leader, Tom Brake, noted that in the first debate on the recall bill, MPs had been worried
over the impact of big money on the recall process. It is therefore vital that recall petitions are proportionately regulated to allow local groups to engage, whilst limiting the capacity for wealthy or overseas campaigners to have a disproportionate influence over the outcome.
An independent MP from Northern Ireland, Lady Sylvia Herman, interrupted. She hoped donors' names in her patch would now be made public under this bill, because at the moment in Northern Ireland,
donations to political parties are still protected by anonymity. I would have absolutely no idea who or what was trying to unseat me.
But she was to be disappointed. Names of donors will not be published in Northern Ireland. The Shadow Deputy Leader of the House of Commons, Thomas Docherty, said despite spending limits, lots of separate groups could be fighting on the same side. Take, for example, the recent Scottish independence referendum.
There was a farmers for yes. There was, I think actually there was a mums for yes. A Christians for yes was another group I remember. All of whom were receiving significant donations from the same individuals.
The Conservative Anne Main interrupted to say that a sitting MP facing recall would be up against every other party, all of them pushing for a by-election.
Each of those groups has one aim, not to get themselves in, but to get the member out. And therefore it's a much more powerful group than the member can field on their own behalf.
The Minister, Tom Brake, agreed that this was a really significant issue. He promised to look at the idea of capping both sides of the argument rather than individual groups to make sure there was equality of arms. You're listening to Today in Parliament here on BBC Radio 4 with me, Susan Hume. Still to come, peers hear from one member who's on the fast track to happiness.
And I have to say the happiest moments of my week are when I get a kiss from all the onboard staff on the East Coast Line on Thursday lunchtime.
But first, the government has been pressed in the House of Lords over when the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq war will conclude its work, amid concerns that there could be a further delay until after May's general election. One peer described the length of the process as a scandal and a disgrace, but the government stressed the need for the inquiry to give those criticised in the report the chance to respond. Here's Simon Jones.
The inquiry led by Sir John Chilcot into the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq and its aftermath began its work in 2009 and held its last hearings in 2011. The five-member panel has said it hopes to begin the next phase of its work soon, contacting those criticised in their report to give them the chance to respond. At question time, a Liberal Democrat, Lord Dykes, suspected there may be other forces at work.
HMG appears to be at the mercy of pressures from outside to connive in a delay in this report, possibly to help Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair. Would he please come back to the Prime Minister's exhortation in May that this should be published by the end of this year at the latest?
For the government, Lord Wallace of Saltaire stressed that the Chilcot inquiry was entirely independent and that it intended to submit its report as soon as possible.
My Lord, I would refute that there is in any sense a conspiracy connected to the former Prime Minister or the former American President. It has taken a good deal longer than what anticipated to clear the many thousands of documents which have been examined and which will be published on the website with a number of redactions. That process is now virtually complete.
Labour's Lord Morgan was not mollified by that.
Is this not a scandal following upon a scandal? Is it not a public disgrace?
There had, he said, been endless delay.
Perhaps the government, as well as the civil service, has ceased to believe in open government.
The Conservative and author Michael, now Lord Dobbs, recognised the difficulties faced by the inquiry, but...
Any further delay after all this time can only increase the sense of injustice that so many people feel about that war.
Lord Wallace said he was very conscious that the inquiry needed to be brought to a close.
I deeply regret that it has taken now 3 years since the end of the interview phase of the inquiry to get as far as we have. We are all of us anxious to complete the next stage, which, as I stress, is showing to those who will be criticised in the report what it says about them, giving them a chance to apply as soon as that is completed. So we are a little dependent on them, I'm afraid to say, and on their lawyers, that the report will be submitted to the Prime Minister and published.
However, Lord Wallace said it would be inappropriate for the report to be published in the immediate run-up to next year's general election, effectively meaning it would have to be ready for publication by the end of February. He also revealed that the cost was expected to reach £10 million by the time of publication. The Lib Dem, Lady Nicholson, had a suggestion.
Sometimes in these enormous investigations, it might be wise to set a time limit with an understanding that there are some things that simply can never be found out.
The Conservative and former Cabinet Minister, Lord Marwini, told the House he had worked closely with Sir John Chilcot.
Is my noble friend concerned that the backstage manoeuvring and perhaps even bickering that is going on as people allegedly seek to protect their reputations can, over a period of time, start to have a damaging effect on the reputation of Sir John Chilcot, which would be a disgrace were that to be allowed to happen?
Lord Wallace said the inquiry did have to allow those it intended to criticise to respond.
And I think we all have to accept that in natural justice, that has to be allowed to go ahead, even if there may be lawyers involved.
The Labour peer and former leader of the Lords, Lord Richard, suggested that could take months.
My Lords, that's a recipe for a delay which will go on and on and on.
Lord Wallace hoped that would not be the case.
Simon Jones reporting there. Now, the government has seen off an attempt to get it to reconsider allowing a public company to bid for rail franchises. Labour wanted the government to go away, look at the issue again and report in 6 months' time. The opposition spokesman Lord Davis pointed to the way the East Coast Mainline service was being run. It's been in public hands since 2009 and Lord Davis said it had returned £600 million to the Treasury. It was, he insisted, a quality service with record levels of passenger satisfaction and punctuality.
The new timetable it introduced in 2011 allows it to operate 7,000 more trains each year and it now has 500,000 more passengers.
Lord Davis argued a public sector operator should be able to challenge the train operators on a level playing field.
That's the way to secure the best deal for passengers and for taxpayers.
But his Labour colleague Lord Snape, a former rail worker, warned against taking a romantic view of the old days when trains were nationalised. He said working under the old regime
was a massively depressing experience. Year after year, the amounts of finance available to the railway industry was a subject of debate. It was quite often cut back. Short-termism was the only way to describe the finances of BR.
And while he was no great supporter of the form of privatisation we had, it had at least given long-term continuity. The crossbencher independent peer Lord Palmer was another fan of the East Coast Main Line. He said he spent an enormous amount of his life on it and believed it would be mad to denationalise it.
And I have to say the happiest moments of my week are when I get a kiss from all the onboard staff on the East Coast Line on Thursday lunchtime.
The Transport Minister, Lady Cramer, said the people who'd come in and stabilised the East Coast Main Line had done a fantastic job, but it was returning money to the Treasury because it wasn't investing in new equipment. As to setting up a public company to bid for franchises, she thought that would cost tens of millions of pounds, money which could be better spent elsewhere.
This is also a business that, even when it's done well, is a high risk, that high overhead, thinly margined business.
Lady Cramer there. Now, you may think that battle lines are being drawn up between Westminster and the rest of the EU, what with rows over EU migration, budget demands and exit noises too. But speaking to MPs on his first day as the UK's new European Commissioner, Lord Hill rejected a suggestion that a period of profound conflict lay ahead. Peter Mulligan reports.
Lord Hill told the Foreign Affairs Committee that he was speaking to them just 12 hours into the job. Before his appointment as Commissioner for Financial Stability, Financial Services and Capital Markets Union, he acknowledged he'd tried to quash speculation that he was in the frame for the role when he was Leader of the Lords.
I was quoted as saying no, 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 as to whether or not I would do this job. Which I did, because it seems to me when you are, and you will all have had this at different times in your careers, when you are presented with a question like that, you can either say yes and fuel all sorts of speculation and cause offence, in that case, to the House of Lords and to the Prime Minister, or you can say no.
He said he hadn't sought the post, though it was hugely important, and it came at a vital moment.
Also a slightly old-fashioned person, which sometimes causes merriment, but I think that if the Prime Minister of your country asks you to do a job, you have to have a pretty good reason to say no. And I thought it was something that I might be able to make a contribution to, and I was delighted to say yes.
The MPs wanted to know what his stance would be. He said it was overwhelmingly in the UK's interests to remain part of the EU. Labour's Mike Gapes, though, drew him towards the latest controversies. David Cameron's desire to curb free movement. The apparent readiness of the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, to see the UK leave. The Commission's unexpected demand for an extra £1.7 billion budget contribution by the first of next month.
Do you have a view that we are in danger of being into a period of profound conflict with the other European Union countries?
No, I don't. And that isn't how it has struck me so far.
He gave the MPs what he called his headline impressions. Firstly, there was almost universal support among other member states for Britain to stay in.
Secondly, that there can be a tendency, both in Britain and elsewhere in Europe, to think and talk in terms of British exceptionalism. I mean, I think we slip into it a bit here in some of our rhetoric sometimes, that I think doesn't always help, and everything always has to be a victory or a defeat.
Mike Gapes intervened, recalling a former Conservative Prime Minister for whom Lord Hill had acted as adviser.
When John Major came back from the Maastricht and game, set and match.
That's a very good example, because that was a phrase. No. That was a phrase he never uttered. And I think the relationship between... You know,
he may not have done, but somebody else
might
have
done on
his behalf.
I don't know, and it certainly wasn't me.
And Lord Hill resumed his argument.
The whole time, different member states are arguing for their own interests just as vigorously, I think, as Britain might do. And I think we collectively, by which I mean, you know, my new colleagues in the EU, need to avoid slipping into that danger, because I don't think it's very healthy, and I think it drives us apart, and I think we should be looking for ways to bring us together.
A Conservative committee member, Andrew Rossendale, focused on a different outcome.
Are you going to make it clear to your fellow commissioners and to everyone else that you work with within the EU that Britain is serious about this, and that coming out of the political union is something actually could very well happen if David Cameron doesn't achieve the serious fundamental renegotiation that we all hope that he's trying to achieve?
Lord Hill made clear he would.
Clearly, part of my job, I think, off portfolio, is to act as a translator, a transmission belt, interpreter, explain to the rest of my colleagues in the EU what the political realities are in the United Kingdom, and the other way back.
But he underlined the alternatives outside the EU in terms of trade and influence were not as attractive as remaining inside.
Peter Mulligan with that report. Finally, it was suggested this afternoon that abolishing the Barnett formula would be a fitting tribute to the man who devised it. The Labour peer Lord Barnett, a former cabinet minister, died on Saturday, aged 91. As Chief Secretary to the Treasury in the 1970s, he came up with the formula for allocating public money to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. But he'd long argued that it was a temporary solution and needed to be replaced. The former leader of Plaid Cymru, Lord Wigley, paid tribute to Lord Barnett.
A lovely, gentle, intelligent colleague who was amongst the first to recognise that the funding formula standing in his name by now needs radical reform.
The Treasury spokesman, Lord Newby, echoed Lord Wigley's opening words.
Lord Barnett was a delight to have as a sparring partner, and I will certainly miss his presence in your Lordship's chamber very much.
But Lord Newby said no change to the formula was planned, a reply challenged by the Conservative and former Scottish Secretary Lord Forsyth.
Could my noble friend explain to me how the vow which was made by all three party leaders in the concluding days of the Scottish referendum, which says that they were committed to sharing our resources equitably across all four nations, is consistent with keeping the Barnett formula?
Lord Newby said the system for funding would change as the country moved towards a greater degree of devolution in Scotland. The final word goes to the economist and Labour peer Lord Peston.
Lord Barnett will be remembered for his formula, but those of us in this House surely will remember that he contributed to a vast number of other topics and therefore deserves to be remembered for all of that as well. Yeah. I think we all agree, my Lord, that he will be missed much more than perhaps some of us will be missed when our time comes.
Lord Peston there. Which brings us to our closing headline. The Home Secretary has apologised to survivors of child sex abuse for the failure to find a new chair of the inquiry after two resignations. I'm Susan Hume, the editor was Alicia McCarthy, and that was Today in Parliament.